We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries and creatives, and stories, music and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. In today's show, we feature the extraordinary Mike Bone with a story called Death of a Volvo, Part 2. Then I do an extended interview with a patient at New Spirit Recovery, a very caring detox center in Encino, and a piece by me called Same Old Song, along with music by the Mills Brothers and the Ink Spots. Stay tuned.
When Lori and I had kids, we decided to get another Volvo wagon, albeit not an 1800 ES. I really wanted to be a soccer dad, and nothing said soccer dad like a Volvo wagon with a ball of soccer balls in the rear. I met this family at Mika's preschool that had leased a 1998 Volvo V70 GLT in silver. The lease was up and they were getting a new car. I bought their old car from them. The V70 had less than 25,000 miles on it. We moved back to California in 2001, and I did indeed become a soccer dad. Mika and Ari both played soccer. I was occasionally asked to be the assistant coach. I know nothing about soccer. I carried a bag of AYSO soccer balls in my car for several years. Next up was surfing. I drove Ari and his surfboard to lifeguard station number 26 twice a week for 3 years. Our surfboard fit neatly inside the V70. Those 6:30 a.m. surf sessions were bracing in January and February. The V70 was worth nothing, zero, nada, zilch. The reason for that is one day I was over at our friends, the Grossmans, picking up some Celeste fig tree cuttings from the tree in their front yard, and a young man backed his camper into my car. The words boom and crash come to mind. At the time of the impact, I was talking to Liz. As I turned around to see my car, now missing its left front fender, and the front bumper looked like a pretzel. The camper van was slowly driving away. Once I started yelling at the driver, the speed of the camper van increased dramatically. The driver was a young man in his 20s, and if left up to him, he would just like to pretend that this meeting of our vehicles had never happened, so he was just going to leave the scene. The camper headed west on Hill Street and did not even slow down at the stop sign at 11th Street. He made a right-hand turn on two wheels and headed to parts unknown. Now, our friend Liz Grossman is an attorney and a mom of four kids. She hopped in her mom van with her daughter Abby at her side and gave chase. Never ever mess with a mom of four, ever. I was standing in the middle of Hill Street with my car in one place, and it's now left front fender in another place, a bumper that didn't look like a bumper at all, and just for good measure, my cell phone died. I had to borrow a cell phone to call the police. Hit and run gets you a police officer, PDQ, in Santa Monica. Before the police could arrive to take a report, up drives Liz. Liz opened the sliding door to her mom van and introduced me to young Max, the driver of the camper. Liz had chased him down and made him get in her van and brought him back to the scene. Like I told you, never ever mess with a mom of four. Needless to say, Max was not happy about being there having to talk with me, and he was really upset when I told him that the police were on the way. Lots of wailing and gnashing of teeth from Max. Much to my surprise, Max passed the field sobriety test. His story about why he left the scene of the accident was heart-wrenching. He and his mom lived in the camper, think nomad land. His mom was in court that day on another matter. There were a lot of outstanding parking tickets on the camper, so it was impounded. Max and his mom were now officially homeless. The police gave me the option of locking Max up or not. Lori and I discussed it and decided to cut Max some slack. He was already having a bad day. He was issued a summons for hit and run, and he had to tell his mom that they were now homeless. Our view of it was that young Max did not need a criminal record to go along with all of that. Liz's husband helped me tie the bumper up so I could drive the car. We put the fender in the back of the car. I'm friends with Mehdi from M's Body Shop down on Lincoln, close enough that I can walk there from our house. We have been friends for years. They have worked on Lori's car and my car in the past. I took the V70 to them. The insurance adjuster came and said, "Nope, we're not going to repair this car. It would cost more to repair it than it's worth." The insurance company gave me $3,500 for the car. M's Body Shop repaired it for $2,000. My position was I just made $1,000 and I got to keep the car. The car now has a salvage title, meaning that it has been totaled at some point. The car is officially worth nothing, like I care. I had a new left front fender and a front bumper. It looked good and ran like a top. The car was perfect for us. Meek and I were learning to drive. I thought eventually one of them would wreck the car. Thank goodness that did not happen. The car had a lot of crumple space front and back. It was a safe car for them to learn to drive. Ari used the V70 to haul his gear to performances by his band, the Chunks. One night he was coming home late from a Chunks performance and he dropped a case full of zildjian cymbals on the street. Not the way to sneak into the house at 2 a.m. 3 years later, Lori's brother and his wife moved to Kauai and sold us their 2011 Volvo XC wagon. Only driven by a school teacher with all the maintenance records, new tires, a new radiator, and a new recent 60,000-mile service. Once again, I am in Volvo station wagon heaven. Mika graduated from USC and got a Mini Cooper. The V70 went to Ari when he enrolled at CalArts in Valencia. He has driven the car for 3 years. The fine folks at BVA nursed it along to 195,000 miles. The goal was for the V70 to get Ari through college. We came close. The V70 would not smog this year. According to the fine folks at BVA, it needed a new $1,300 air pump, but there was no guarantee that the car would smog after that repair. Time to move on. California has a vehicle retirement program that gets older cars that are polluters off the road. Today, we took the V70 to a certified recycler. As I drove the V70 east on the 10 freeway, Lori was behind me in our new, parentheses, 2011 Volvo XC. She called me twice to tell me that the car I was driving, the 23-year-old Volvo V70, was smoking a lot. It did not overheat, and it made it into the lot under its own power as per the regulations. The Nafshinbone family drove that V70 for 170,000 miles. Mika and Ari learned to drive in that car. The car never let us down. Goodbye, old friend.
Today is September 13th, 2021. Mystic Pete here with Cole.
Yes, sir.
We are at some swanky treatment center in Encino. How did you get here?
Well, I was originally in Arizona for a year doing treatment, and I did a whole circle of treatments in Arizona and just getting kicked out of one after another after another after another. And then I ended up homeless, but one of these treatments in Arizona cared about me enough to where they actually got me a ride to Phoenix and bought me a plane ticket to where I flew out here and was picked up and taken into this treatment center. So I've been pretty lucky. You know, I was homeless and they got me here. They don't want to see me on the streets.
Wow. Did you come from a rough background?
I grew up in Michigan, just outside of Detroit, and, you know, addiction runs in the family. There's addiction everywhere in the community. Yeah, I wouldn't say rough background, but definitely around a lot of drugs. I grew up around a lot of drugs, you know, started, you know, smoking weed, drinking, selling drugs when I was 13, 14, and then 15, 16, 17, it all got worse and worse and worse. And by the time I was 18, you know, I was renting a house that I sold a lot of different things out of.
Trap house.
A nice one.
Nice trap house.
But yeah, pretty much.
Leather furniture.
Yeah, pretty much. Overdoses in that house were, I don't want to say common, but there was, you know, a fair number of overdoses in that house. You know, always kept Narcan around. And just being around heroin and seeing what it does to people has kept me away from heroin. So I personally just decided to stay away from heroin. But I got into Xanax and other benzos pretty bad, and drinking pretty bad, and that was kind of my downfall. So from 18 to 21, with the benzos and the drinking, you know, I kind of was drinking myself to death. I was a functioning alcoholic, though. I held a great job where I ran a kitchen from 19 to 21, where I was able to just get hammered before work, drink at work, and then obviously drink when I get home. And I was functioning, I was able to do that.
But you were the boss.
I was the boss. No one could tell me no.
But that means you must have a lot of personal resources. You must be an effective person. Like, you're good at what you do.
I was
whether
great.
It's cooking or selling drugs.
Yeah, I was great at both. Not that selling drugs is hard, no. But yeah, I was great at both.
But then you must be good with people, running a kitchen.
Yeah, I was fairly good with people. I had to earn respect being 19, telling 30, 40-year-olds what to do. I had to earn respect, and I got respect really quickly, you know. But yeah, you have to earn respect for sure, and it takes time, but I was able to do it quickly, and I was good at what I was doing, you know. I was very highly functioning, but I was also just, like, destroying my body.
Well, the fact that you were able to be in a position of authority, competence, power at some level, that means there's good options for the future, in the sense that, you know, you're not just some wreck of a human being. You know, there's a lot to you. You have a lot of substance.
Yeah, I got a number of skills, so hopefully in the future I'm able to take advantage of that. You know, but currently, just in this last year, you know, my alcoholism has just been kind of hindering all that and kind of just keeping me in the same, you know, pattern of going to treatment, getting kicked out, going to treatment, going to sober living, getting kicked out, you know.
Because you keep, like,
I keep relapsing, I keep drinking.
I see.
You know, I do well for a month, 2 months, 3 months, and that's it.
Was there violence in your past?
Yeah, there was violence around me. I generally stayed pretty much out of violence. You know, there was always something going on, you know, just being a teenager, you know, people with guns, people selling guns and getting involved with different things that I generally kept myself out of.
Michigan? We think of Michigan as this upstanding state.
Yeah, right? With Detroit being as great as it is. You know, Detroit's it's a shell of a city.
Yeah.
It's only people that are there are stuck in. They're stuck there. You know.
I see. They've had so much tragedy, and on so many levels.
Yeah.
And unemployment, and just bitterness, mm-hmm. and health issues.
Yep. So there's a lot of people that are unemployed. You know, they make their rent by selling drugs, by selling guns, and you know, when somebody has a lot of money, a lot of different things that they can, you know, take. People will break into houses, you get home invasions, you get, you know, drug-related shootings and home invasions and stuff like that.
What's the worst violence you saw?
Oh, there was, you know, I've been involved in some different, you know, there's some shootings and different occurrences like that, mostly just drug related, or people that just fighting over, you know, fighting over a space, you know, fighting over their own, how do I put it, you know, blocks fighting over different blocks.
Territory.
Yeah.
Turf battles.
Yeah.
It's over nothing, really. It's just like, this is my space that's like...
Yeah.
Like, I want this.
Yeah, like, this is my space. This is, you know, people trying to do their thing too close to each other, and they don't like it. You know, somebody wants to be on top, and someone else comes in, and they butt heads. And people start shooting, people start breaking indoors, you know.
And then we're just a kind of baboons, like, fighting over territory.
Yep, pretty much. And, you know, for a while, I got involved with, you know, we started dealing with guns and making different, you know, making AR-15s.
Homemade?
Not yet. Yes and no. So there's a specific part of an AR-15 that's called the lower receiver that is considered the weapon. It's considered the firearm. Every other piece of the gun is just a piece. It's just a part. So you can have all these parts except for this lower receiver shipped to your door. But loophole around that is we would order these 90% lower receivers that get around that law. So you can have these 90% lower receivers shipped to your door, and then you finish the other 10% of it yourself. And now you're building ghost guns.
And these are machine guns. These are powerful weapons.
These are, you know, 223-556 caliber, you know, semi-automatic rifles that, you know, 30-round magazines. And you can build them however you want. You can build different calibers, 30 calibers, you know, 9mm calibers. You can put a 5-6 inch barrel on it, make it a pistol. So you can essentially have a pistol that shoots a rifle round that is going to travel through most types of walls.
It'll go through cinder blocks.
Yeah, you'll shoot people through car doors. You know, it'll go through multiple people. You know, so just
multiple people. Don't want to waste ammunition here. Yeah. One bullet, you know.
So there's a lot of money in that, you know, obviously, because there's a lot of people that can't get guns. You know, if you're a convicted felon, you can't just go to your local gun store and buy a gun. But you can go to somebody you know and buy a gun from them. And, you know, the government has no idea about these guns, where they're going, who has them. So you have all these felons that are violent offenders that are now, you know, they got a bunch of, you know, rifles, AR-15s, Glocks, you know, different weapons, and they don't care to, you know, they'll shoot because there's certain spots, you know, the police learn not to go to, you know, because there's certain spots that
it's too dangerous.
You call the police and you tell them you're on this and this street, and they're basically like, all right, and that's about it.
You on your own.
Yeah, that's about it. Because they get shot at. You know, they're not going to send, you know, one patrol car to go check out a scene when they show up to the scene and start getting shot at. You know, it turns into like a war zone.
They'd have to send a SWAT team.
Yeah.
For any little disturbance, otherwise they're risking their life.
Yeah, which is a waste of resources. You know, they can't send a SWAT team to every shooting call. You know, it's just not possible. It's just not, they can't do that. If they could, they would, but they can't. So
right. There's a certain amount of resources.
Yeah, so people just, you know, they learn to protect themselves. They carry, and in Michigan you have to have a special license to conceal carry, and everybody is concealed carrying. So then you have problems with people getting pulled over, people getting arrested for, you know, whatever reason whatever thing they were doing, and now they're getting gun charges, and now all the prisons are filling up, and you know, you get gun charges, you get assault charges, and it's just, it's a whole mess.
And once you're in the system, you're stigmatized. You can't get work. Once you have a record, who wants you around?
Yeah, so who wants to hire a violent, you know, felon? So then what do?
Right.
You go back to what you know how to do.
And even if you get out of jail or get clean, the people you like to hang out with, they're in the scene, and you're back in as soon as you want to hang out with your old buddies, friends.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people, they just go home, and that's back to what
it's back in it.
It's back in it.
20 minutes later.
That's right? Back in it, you know. It's getting a little bit better because there's less people. You know, it's turning into more of a skeleton. Like I said, there's less people in Detroit, so things are kind of, you know, it's not like Chicago. Like, Chicago's booming, so there's more and more people, and you got these places like O Block, these places like, you know, 63rd, 64th, 65th Street, which are just complete war zones because they're just loaded with people. You know, and then you got places in Florida that are just loaded with people.
And guns.
And guns.
And a lot of cocaine.
A lot of cocaine, a lot of heroin. So you have that everywhere. Every city you go to, you have that. In Detroit, it's just, there's no money in the government system, so there's not many police, there's not many resources, so people just get away with things, or they end up in the system, they go right back to what they were doing. So, but to answer your original question, like, I was never in a gang. I stayed away. I did my best to stay away from all that stuff. I had great friends that would do a lot of things for me, so people didn't, you know, really mess with me, bother me too much, you know. And I also wasn't like selling drugs on that level to where people were kicking in my door.
You weren't a big fish, so
no.
Not being attacked for or robbed.
Yeah, for, yeah. And people knew I had guns, so you know why. It just wouldn't make sense for somebody to come kick in my door and get shot at over a couple thousand dollars worth of stuff.
Well, there's three parts to it. There's the protecting yourself with firearms. There's the money to be made selling guns. But there's also the power of it. Mm. There's the thrill, the charge of being violent.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously there's something to being a predator, mm-hmm. that is very compelling.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. That's why selling guns is so easy. You know, it's people want to be on top. People want to be in charge. And a whole other thing too that's a lot of people don't think about. Certain people enjoy gunfights. They enjoy violence. They enjoy shooting at other people. You know, I don't know if you've ever shot a gun off inside of a room or a house, but it's loud. It's loud. There's a flash of, you know, there's a fireball. There's a smell to it. There's a number of people out there that enjoy doing that.
You feel alive. There's power to it.
Yeah.
And there's also power to being brutal and to making people scared. Seeing fear in other people's eyes. I think in polite society, that's almost like, how could you? But let's face it, there's something to that. It's an animal ecstasy to it.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Even to hurting people.
Yep. Yep. So that's some people, you know. Everybody wants a thrill. Some people, that, you know, they get it that way.
Because we feel powerless in this world. Yeah. We're just these little ants, these little cogs in this massive machine that has no say-so on about anything in some respects. But by being cruel, violent, hurting others, you know, there's a moment of, like, meaning. I don't know, I'm getting kind of crazy here,
no,
but
it's true.
You were a part of or adjacent to that life. You saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you enjoyed those moments from time to time.
Had a lot of good times. A lot of bad times, a lot of good times.
Yeah, yeah. So it's intense living.
Yeah.
Why is every other movie about criminal life or criminal? You know, like, obviously people are obsessed with this and enchanted, engaged, want to be a part of it, want to pretend.
Mm-hmm.
So many white boys running around pretending to be some kind of thug or something.
You get that a lot. Yep. That's for sure. You get that a lot. Unfortunately, a lot of them end up getting themselves into things that, you know, they don't realize. You know, they think they can be 1 foot in, 1 foot out.
They want to pretend they're hard and they're all tough and ghetto.
Yeah. You know, there's repercussions for, you know, you kick in someone's door, you know, you put everybody on the ground, you take whatever they got on the table in the safe, and you leave. Well, guess what? Next week, they come in, kick in your door, and instead of just putting you on the ground, they shoot you in the back of the head. There's repercussions. You know, right. There's repercussions. You can't be, people want to be 1 foot in, 1 foot out.
I see. When you're in the underworld, there's no rules.
Yeah, there's no rules.
And it's a bigger fish is going to come along and eat you.
Yeah. Yeah. And where there's bad people, you know, you think you're bad, you think you're tough, you think you're big, there's always somebody bigger and badder than you.
Of course.
You know?
And the baddest dude is the guy up in the top of the
yep.
building wearing a business suit.
That's true.
That doesn't...
doesn't touch anybody.
Yeah, but
he just tells people what to do.
Yeah, it's this whole organization.
Yeah, that's true. That's also true.
What's the interaction between the different races of people relative to this situation?
So, generally, in Michigan, you know, black people look at white people like they have money. So let's say I go down in the city in Detroit, stop at a gas station, and I'm by myself, and somebody sees me in my car and what my shoes and my shirt and like what I'm wearing, they're gonna, you know, they might look at me and be like, you don't belong here, like you gotta get going, you know. But
there's a lot of tension.
There's a lot of tension, but there's also a lot of, you know, people earn respect. So like people respected me. So I didn't have any problems, you know, when it came to white, black, brown, yellow, purple. I didn't have any problems. But a lot of people do have problems, you know.
Racism, I mean, that can go both ways.
A lot of people do have problems, especially in you know, in prison, in the jail system, in county. But...
you have to align with a certain group.
Yeah.
You have to get on board, otherwise you're vulnerable.
Yeah. On the street, a lot people generally stick to their own race.
So the war is not so much warfare between tribes, but within tribes.
Within tribes, for sure.
It's a lot of territory.
Yeah, within tribes, way more than just like black against white crime.
Yeah. Interesting about that.
You know, that's at least in the city. Like, there's not a whole lot of, like, yeah, black on white crime. It's more just, you know, what I was talking about earlier, people fighting over certain things.
All right, so let's get lofty a minute here. I'm expecting you to solve all the society's problems right now. So, like... how does this solve? Where's the resolution for this? I mean, obviously this is all pretty dead end stuff. This doesn't lead to, like, you know, people having stable lives and nice families and relax and playing in their yard. I mean, like, this is it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It's temporary. It's not sustainable. You know, it's not like a forest that's sustainable. It's a forest that's getting cut down. I mean, I don't know what I'm asking.
Yeah.
I'm asking a very big question, but just as somebody who saw the gritty underbelly,
mm-hmm.
I mean, is it laws have to be passed, or got to clean up the neighborhoods, or more education, or speculate for me.
All right. In my opinion.
And answer the whole thing right now. You have 30 seconds.
I got you. No, in my opinion, though, it's never going to be fixed. It'll never be perfect. There's always going to be drugs. If anything, there's just going to be more drugs and stronger drugs. There's always going to be violence. You know, if anything, there's going to be more violence. I don't think passing any laws is going to change a whole lot. You know, that just great example. Felons can't own firearms. There's a lot of felons that own a lot of firearms, you know. So the laws, I don't think, are going to do a whole lot.
So that law does nothing?
No, it just prevents you from going to a conventional store.
And that runs up the price of guns?
Yes.
On the black market?
Yes. It runs
so up it price. Makes more crime in some respects.
Yes, because now you have people that, you know, make their living from selling those guns, from making those guns. And guess what? They get to charge twice the price.
And the people buying them who are felons have to get the money to pay for it someplace.
So they sell kilos of cocaine. They sell pounds of marijuana. They sell kilos of heroin. They, you know, that eventually make it into teenagers' hands who overdose and die every single day. My best friend overdosed on heroin. Whew. You know, it's... There will always be drugs. And in the last couple of years with the fentanyl, it's only has gotten a lot worse. They're putting fentanyl in everything now.
Oh, just to bump up the potency.
Yeah.
They call it whatever it is. It gets you high. You're not arguing if it's an MDA high or a Xanax high. It's getting you high.
They're putting it in everything. Recently, which this doesn't make sense to me. Recently, they've been putting fentanyl in cocaine.
I see.
Which, you know, cocaine's an upper. Fentanyl is a synthetic opiate. It's a downer. So people are, you know, the regular users of cocaine think, you know, they're snorting cocaine, then they snort fentanyl and take three steps and collapse and die. It's amazing. Well,
cool. I'm a little disappointed because I was hoping in 30 seconds you would solve this entire problem of civilization.
Yeah, that's up to smarter people than me.
Jeez.
I'm not too optimistic about the future.
Well, you just have such an incredible insight, though. I mean, it seems like you could do a lot kind of teaching on the teaching level, or the helping people. Is that at all interest to you?
Yeah, I'd love to. I don't know how I would, but I'd love to.
Yeah.
Just drug education needs to be a bigger thing than it is currently.
Yeah.
You know, just people understanding different drugs, what they do, you know, what they can do to you, how people's lives turn. You know, people just need to hear more stories about what these drugs have done to them and taken away from them.
Wow. And also, maybe I'll just throw in here, but I think obviously there has to be more resources for families. I mean, if families are users, I mean, like, there has to be more support for people, like, kind of on the grassroots level, and also more employment for people. Like, if you put in resources in these real life ways, you know, you're going to be breaking some of the cyclical nature of it, or people who are desperate don't have... If you have a good job, you know, you're going to be less likely to just blow it all on something kind of silly, right? Mm-hmm. Unemployment, I'm sure, has something to do with this.
Yeah, unemployment. Recently, you know, people are making more from unemployment than they would be, you know, working a low wage job. So they don't even have the initiative to go get a job, because why would they? They could sit at home and make more.
That's interesting occurrence.
I don't know how that's gonna play out.
Put the pandemic on top of this all and swirl it around.
Yeah,
and things even become more complicated. Any final words, Cole?
Stay away from heroin. Stay away from cocaine. You know, alcohol is a hell of a drug. Wow. In my opinion, alcohol is one of the worst drugs. Hmm. It's socially acceptable.
The legal one?
The legal one is socially acceptable.
Boom.
And it kills, and it ruins lives. So drink responsibly. That's it for me.
Thanks, brother.
they go, the smoke rings I blow each night. Oh, what do, those circles of blue and white? Why do they seem to picture a dream of love then? Why do they fade that phantom parade of love? Your cares away. Puff, 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 night and day. Blow, blow them into air, silky little rings. Blow, blow them everywhere, give your troubles wings. I love, please take me above, take me with you.
Same old song. There's no accounting for why we repeat the same pointless ritual despite failure after failure. We spin through the radio dial trying to find original, interesting content. Click, heard it. Click, boring. Click, meh. Different voices, embellished arrangements, but the same old songs. I sometimes think that rather than listening to this stuff, I'd prefer to have molten lead poured into my ears. Perhaps all the songs have been written. However, there remains four wide veins of musical gold ready for further excavation. Each still holds a mother lode. First, experimentation. Getting musically messy, sloshing around in creative mud, is at the heart of originality. We've had a wonderful experimental workshop environment at local coffee shops where we find the open mic scene. This seething hatchery at the bottom of Southern California's creative evolutionary ladder allows emerging artists to get on stage comfortably because they couldn't possibly do worse than the person before them, work through their material, and fall on their behind. It's how you learn. Every seasoned musician has fallen on their behind. Lord knows I have. As evidence, I've got calluses back there. From mistakes, all kinds of creation erupts. Iconic moments have come from lucky accidents. The last enigmatic line of the last Beatles album was an accident. Someday I'm going to make her mine. Today, anyone can be a musician. The equipment required for high-fidelity recording, which would have cost $100,000 a few decades ago, can be cobbled together by a teenage music geek in his parents' basement with a family computer, free software, and a microphone. Because of this do-it-yourself era, the experimental spirit thrives. Music software is so advanced that a chimp can push a few buttons and knock out a tune that's at least average. With music so easy to create, the whole world via the internet has access to limitless quantities. On the one hand, it is wonderful that so many people can now call themselves musicians instead of just a small elite. On the other hand, the river of song flowing down the web pipeline is mostly unremarkable. Perhaps chimps are involved. While the enterprising lone artist may find new opportunities, it is tough for anyone to get their head above this ocean of waves. By the way, that's spelled period W-A-V-S. It's a music file type. The joke works better on paper. Next, great music is fertilized by cross-pollination. When African, Native American, French, and European sounds, mixed with bare-chested women throwing beads during all-night drunken carnivals in a town called New Orleans, a quirky new form of music was born called jazz. When that sound swung to South America and swirled amongst Gilberto, Jobim, and Mendez, and then was reimagined by Stan Getz, Herbie Mann, and Chick Corea, Brazilian jazz spread internationally. Jazz is only half there without Brazil. Jazz got married in Brazil. Coming full circle, we now have U.S. hip-hop artists using world beats that can be heard pounding in favelas back in Rio. Great movements of art generally come from scenes. It is no accident that a bounty of exceptional song emerged when Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Joan Baez, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, James Taylor, Carole King, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, the Eagles, etc., etc., inspired each other. A new genre exploded from the resonance of the 60s, 70s folk rock music scene. Los Angeles is the mecca of musical amalgamation. I love visiting other cultures, but save the cost of airplane tickets here in LA by just getting in my car and driving a few miles to the next neighborhood. Plus, other countries won't let us in anymore. Have you tasted the food and heard the music at the Wat Thai Temple in North Hollywood? Pop music loves this kind of mix, and that means there is plenty of money to be made by blending together the sounds of different cultures. I remember in 1998 counting at least five different styles in Ricky Martin's mega hit Livin' La Vida Loca. Pop, salsa, rock, ska, and surf. Third, profound art is found inside. I know you've heard that before, but let me explain. Here in LA, where every musician from Dubai to Dusseldorf come to get rich and famous, just getting time on stage is difficult, especially now that all the stages are closed. You have to turn on the sound system yourself after a crowbar opening the front door. Plentiful, well-paying gigs? Yeah, dream on. On the bright side, pack a city with desperate musicians, and only brilliance will shine through. Such desperation and fierce competition for limited resources, concert venues, label contracts, TV and movie placements, leads the artist either to simply give up, compromise their work, or search deep inside self for something extraordinary. Only extraordinary art has the buoyancy to rise to the top of this sea of talent. The rivalries and collaborations, the pushing and pulling, draws Darwin from the Galapagos tide pools to Los Angeles nightclubs. Again, currently dark to accommodate a plague, a temporary situation, we hope. Los Angeles is frankly a hard place to be a musician, yet it naturally selects for genius. Hence, we may see a potent new kind of music emerge here in LA. Have we the strength to find it within? In a time of confinement, where else are we going to find liberation? A smart and right now necessary strategy. In my opinion, the richest region for that inward search is in our emotions. When did music become so emotionally monotone? Pop trends, happy sexy. Rap, angry sexy. Punk, rebellious. Country, sentimental. Gospel, inspirational. Today, each musical genre is limited, by and large, to one emotional tone. I've seen operas that are alternatively beautiful, riotous, terrifying, and heartbreaking. 100 years ago, people went to the opera to laugh, weep, rejoice, and be taken on a journey. When the final curtain fell, the audience had been destroyed and born again. Where is that musical journey today? Musicians of old wielded passion to save souls from the bog of monotony. Whether in a concert stadium or an online rave, only by plumbing the deepest of emotions can the musician free those who are comfortably numb. In the artist's furthest extremities and darkest core lie the fresh information that people hunger to find in the arts. Lastly, we can mine the forgotten past. There are vast deposits calling to us, hoping to be found. A couple of dozen times in my life, I've heard a wondrous tune from a genre that I didn't know anything about, and roared out a thunderstruck, "What?" I follow the flow of air from the passageway through which it came, find treasures, and these words come out of my mouth. How did I not know about this? I'm classically trained and always kind of liked opera. But when I started seeing it live at the Dorothy Chandler, I was like, oh my God! KXLU host Catherine Free's Monday Night at the Opera helped expand my appreciation of its endless wealth. KXLU's Cowboy Nick led me to classic country. I guess I concluded a while back that country was corny or such, but changed my mind after really taking in Hank Williams, Merle Haggard, Waylon Jennings, George Jones, Loretta Lynn, and on, with Cowboy Nick as my guide. There are gems in anime soundtracks, Greek rhymbitica, Indonesian gamelan music. One of my biggest hauls came years ago when I first heard the song Smoke Rings by the Mills Brothers. That led me to the Ink Spots. As early jazz and swing from the 1920s and 30s illuminated my life, honestly, I became richer. Sophisticated audiences demand compelling, visionary music. We recognize great music because in the hearing, we are transformed. From a wild, uneasy place comes such rare art. And for their impossible struggle, both inward and outward, we must support musicians because their acts of creation give voice to the Creator. Here then, for your listening pleasure, some of the greatest music I've ever heard, songs by the Mills Brothers and the Ink Spots.
My prayer is to linger with you at the end of the day, in a dream that's divine, my prayer is a rapture in blue, with the world far away, and your lips close to mine. Tonight, while our hearts are aglow, oh, tell me the words that I'm longing to know. My prayer and the answer you give, may they still be the same. For as long as we live, that you'll always be there at the end of my prayer.
My prayer is to linger with you at the end of each day in a dream that's divine. My prayer is a rapture in blue with the world far away, and your lips close to mine.
Tonight, while our hearts are aglow, oh, tell me the words that I'm longing to know. My prayer and the answer you give, may they still be the same. For as long as we live, that you'll always be there at the end of my breath.
We are coming to the end of the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started today's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Death of a Volvo, Part 2. Then I did an interview with a patient at New Spirit Recovery, a wonderful detox center in Encino. And then a piece by me called Same Old Song. And the music we heard was Smoke Rings by the Mills Brothers and Till We Meet Again by the Ink Spots. We'll be back next week with more interviews and entertainment. Thank you so much for listening. Mystic Pete out!